rocket science meets political science and inspiring cosmic images from JWST. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. President-elect Donald Trump is picking his new cabinet as his administration eyes another 4 years in the White House. His previous term saw big moves in space, from a commitment to land humans on the moon through NASA's Artemis program to the first commercial mission to launch NASA astronauts. So what's ahead for the next term? We'll speak with Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about how NASA and commercial space companies may fare during Trump's next administration. Then, from images of galaxy clusters to stars deep in our universe, the James Webb Space Telescope has captured detailed cosmic images from billions of miles away. We'll speak with Florida Tech's Eric Perlman about some of his favorite images from JWST and how the telescope changed the way we look towards space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? With President-elect Donald Trump now returning to the White House as the 47th president of the United States, NASA will get a new administrator. This crucial role, as well as other roles, like the relationship between the vice president and the National Space Council, could determine how the U.S. approaches space policy and exploration over the next 4 years and beyond. But what did NASA look like under the Trump administration during his first term as president? And what could it look like over the next few years? Here to answer those questions and talk about how policy can shape space exploration is Casey Dreyer. He's the chief of space policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back so soon.
Casey, before we start thinking about space policy under another Trump administration, I'm wondering if you could just take us back to the first Trump term and what were some of the highlights of space policy under Trump 45?
The first Trump administration was very unusually productive in terms of its space policy. Highlights, I think, obviously, the establishment of the Space Force as a new branch of the armed services. You had the implementation and pursuit of Artemis, the Artemis Accords, and then a number of space policy directives coming from the White House that aimed to streamline regulations, clarify certain types of approaches to space development, space power, and then also reconnaissance and communication. So it was a very unusually productive and broadly accepted. It was not a partisan set of priorities that came out of it, as evidenced by the subsequent Biden administration didn't roll back any of those space policy directives or reformulate the Artemis program.
Did those policies kind of carry over into the Biden administration? And indeed they did, you're saying, right?
Absolutely. And Artemis in particular, I always like to emphasize, that was the first lunar program that really survived a presidential transition since Apollo went from Lyndon Johnson to Richard Nixon in 1969. Arguably, you could even say that Nixon barely accepted it. He took the landings and then wound down the program. So that pass off from one Republican administration to Democratic was a very successful demonstration, again, of the smart bipartisan policy that the people who worked for the first Trump administration established in terms of policy development.
I know Jim Bridenstine, who was NASA's administrator under the first Trump administration, got a lot of credit and kudos for doing that. Was the way that Bridenstine tackled policy, did he look to make sure that it extended throughout multiple terms and that was the strategy of it and that's why it worked? I guess what I'm asking, Casey, is who can we credit this policy transfer from one administration to the next?
Certainly, Jim Bridenstine was a very important part of that. I would add Scott Pace, who is the executive secretary of the National Space Council. The National Space Council itself was reconstituted under the last Trump administration. And Mike Pence, who was the vice president under the first administration, also just personally loved space and took a very active role in space policy and establishing space policy. Obviously, they can be quite partisan individuals. They're all Republicans. But very importantly to me, they all truly respect and value space and NASA. And again, you know, space is not a hyper-partisan part of government. There's no innate Republican or Democratic platform on space exploration. And that also makes it a lot easier. It became an opportunity, and I think it was embraced as an opportunity by the individuals who participated in that administration's first space term to really drive some opportunities for compromise and a broad embrace of these values.
We know that this was a very politically divisive election. Do you foresee that space policy will continue to remain partisan? And can it be used as that olive branch to try to bridge divides between a very polarized Democratic and Republican Party going into this next presidential administration?
This is where we start to run into prognostications that we don't really have a lot of information yet. The key things to watch will be who the Trump administration appoints into these roles. So who is going to be the NASA administrator, the deputy administrator? Who's going to be the executive secretary of the Space Council? J.D. Vance is a very different person than Mike Pence in a lot of ways, and so far has not expressed any sort of innate interest in space. Does that mean he will develop it? It could. That would be great, or show some hidden side. But we just really don't know who the individuals are. They tend to be rather late appointees after you go through some of the major government agencies. But that's something to surely watch. And I very much, again, hope it is, and it certainly can be. One of my things that I worry about going forward is that space, which has been blessedly nonpartisan for so long, may, by the dint of its prioritization and attention garnered, particularly with a Mars program potentially in the next administration, could itself induce partisan opposition by the mere fact that it's embraced by the head of the Republican Party. It'll naturally kind of be more easily opposed by the opposition parties.
I want to get into kind of what you're observing in the future. But before we get to that, you mentioned something about Pence and Vance. And I remember during the 2016 election, Mike Pence was in Florida and the Space Coast quite often campaigning there. He did have a very prominent role, as you mentioned, in space policy, made a lot of visits to Kennedy Space Center for human space flight. Just how consequential was Vice President Pence and the National Space Council in getting a lot of this policy in place during that first term? And are there indications that that will continue in Trump's second term?
I think it's instructive to compare, actually, the output of the National Space Council under the first Trump administration with Mike Pence and then under Biden with Kamala Harris as VP. Harris liked space, but clearly didn't have the same level of personal fascination and interest that Mike Pence did. And just comparing just the number of meetings was far higher under Pence. They were high, kind of very visible, very theatrical presentations in these dramatic locations. He would gather all the leading agency heads of the DOD and Commerce Department. And, you know, he would emphasize, in a sense, this broad cross-cutting nature of space into all these different aspects of government. And he would very much say, I want this result by the next meeting. I want you to do this in the next few months. You know, it is very clear, is very productive. They were hitting the ground running. And again, that's very much, I think, the vice president sets that expectation. Also, it's the relationship of the vice president to the president creates the ability to move policy through the system. You know, the vice president doesn't have any formal role in the executive branch. They succeed based on the implied closeness and alignment with the president himself. So Pence was very much that, obviously, up until the very end of the first Trump administration. And it'll remain to be seen how the relationship evolves between Vance and Trump himself, but also, again, where Vance wants to put his energy towards. He may like it, but will he put his limited amounts of time and energy to prioritizing that? That's what we will look for. And I think that's what we will start to see as we move forward, how quickly they embrace some of these things. Or I guess we should just acknowledge this now, right? That you have this Elon Musk role floating around in this very unusual, potentially very powerful, but again, ahistorical way that makes it hard to model exactly what the outcome of that will be.
I do want to acknowledge how difficult it is to predict the future, and you do not have a crystal ball here. So, you know, but you did mention Elon Musk and this focus on now Mars. Do you anticipate an even greater focus on human spaceflight than the previous administration?
I do think that's a likely outcome here. It's worth dwelling on. Elon Musk has become clearly at the moment one of Trump's favorite people. He is exerting quite a bit of influence, or at least input, into Trump himself. They seem to have a very positive and close relationship. And obviously, Elon Musk really did a lot of work to get Trump reelected. And now you have the situation where you have, you know, not just the wealthiest person in the world, but the person who runs the most capable space company that has ever existed, very closely aligned with the president of the United States, basically pitching, what if we go to Mars in 4 years? Just let us do it, you know, unleash us and let us do it. That could be a really exciting thing. for human spaceflight. Where science and all the other aspects of NASA fall in beyond this becomes a much more open question and will really, I think, rely on who that NASA administrator is and then what the goal of NASA will be really in this administration. But I think we can already see human spaceflight and in Trump himself, whenever he speaks extemporaneously about space, you'll notice he always talks about Mars and humans to Mars. And Trump is nothing if not intuitively very capable of understanding the power of symbols and the symbolic power of, you know, sending Americans to Mars before anyone else. While everyone else is going to the moon, we have Americans at Mars. Obviously, by the end of a second term, even better, right? You have a potent opportunity here. A lot of this starts to become, you know, it depends on exactly how this is formulated, but what could they do if completely unleashed? Now, obviously, there are going to be consequences to that. I mean, we have a regulatory regime for a reason, at least in the ideal case. And there's always the possibility that Elon Musk and Trump himself could have some sort of falling out, right? A lot of people tend to do that with Trump, and he will move on from people if he, you know, if they want to share too much of the attention and limelight, that's always a risk. And of course, Elon Musk is used to being the one making the decisions, and Trump is the one used to making the decisions. So there's an innate instability in that relationship, but at the moment they seem very tight. And that could very well pay off for human spaceflight, particularly with refocusing it on, or at least in parallel, really making a push to Mars.
And finally, Casey, are there concerns that NASA's science initiatives may get lost in this new focus? And also, Trump plans to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Could there be cuts to NASA's climate science division?
In addition to this question, I want to expand it a bit because we talk about space policy, but I think the potential consequences to, in this case, NASA as a federal agency, there's a lot of potential consequences to NASA based on other priorities of the campaign in terms of how they're going to be approaching the federal workforce and federal bureaucracy. In addition to what you laid out with the science budgets and climate, which obviously I think would be an obvious point of focusing for cuts. Elon Musk himself has talked about this Department of Government Efficiency trying to wrangle back $2 trillion of cuts out of federal spending, whether that's possible or not. But just despite that, we have higher inflation than we did. We have higher interest rates than we did. And so there's a lot of pressure. And then, you know, and then Trump, of course, has promised a lot of things like tax cuts and other things that would diminish government returns. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to cut spending in general. If they're going to prioritize human spaceflight, that spending cuts will probably, and we're already seeing, right, just in the last couple of years, from modest spending cuts, disproportionate cuts to the science side of NASA. It's the only other really big ticket area besides human spaceflight. The other aspect of this is maybe you end the SLS program. Maybe you end Orion finally, right? The problem is those are all primarily focused in Republican states. Will Trump pick a fight with members of his own party and allow Elon Musk or whomever to try to cancel SLS, which for all its flaws as a program has retained rock solid foundational support from Congress as recently as a month ago when the Republican-led House of Representatives passed their NASA reauthorization bill that included a whole section on just basically reemphasizing how much they love the SLS and how committed to it Congress is. So it's easy to say to cut waste, but a lot of people's waste are someone else's key district, you know, in-district program that keeps jobs and so forth. Where will Trump spend his political capital? Where will he attach the focus? Those are all things I worry about. There's additional stuff with, you know, if you're putting on tariffs, how does that impact the aerospace supply chain? Will that make projects more expensive, no matter for whom?
Lots to keep an eye on. Glad we have someone like you to do it. Casey Dreyer is the chief of space policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks so much for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, gas pillars, exploding stars, and galactic phenomena.
Just for everybody who's listening, this is a cloud of gas that's forming lots and lots of stars in our own galaxy.
The best yet of JWST. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. In 2021, the James Webb Space Telescope launched a mission to peer deeper into our universe and farther into our cosmic past than ever before.
Liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself, James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
From peering into the atmospheres of exoplanets to capturing the formation of new stars, JWST data has reshaped the way scientists study our universe, and its images allow the public to see into the beauty and wonder of our cosmos. Here to talk more about JWST's impact and share his favorite images of late from the telescope is Eric Perlman. He's a professor of physics and space sciences at Florida Tech. Eric, always great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Brandon.
So we thought it would be a good time to kind of look outward from our planet and highlight some images captured by JWST, the space-based telescope. We've had you on the program a few times to talk about some of your favorite images, but we're going to start with the JADES Transient Survey image. I'm looking at it now. It looks like speckled dots, much like Hubble's Deep Field. What is this image I'm looking at?
It is a deep field image, but there's something different about it. So what you are looking at is repeated images. This was a deep field that was taken a couple of different times, and it's not only faint galaxies and such, but particularly we're looking for things that changed in brightness during that time. The repeat observations were about a year apart. These could be supernovae, they could be novae, they could also be things like tidal disruption events, which are when a star passes too close to the black hole that's in the center of a galaxy. This is a new frontier in astrophysics and astronomy. So we have these two new observatories. One's just about to open up. The other one is going to be launched in 2 years. The first one is the Rubin LSST in Chile, which is supposed to see first light within a couple of months. And then the second one is the Roman. And both of them are looking for these transient objects. And the transient universe is an exciting thing because these supernovae can tell us all sorts of things about how stars die. They can tell us about the structure of our universe and about cosmology. These tidal disruption events, they can tell us about what's going on in the centers of galaxies, kind of removed from, you know, we talk about black holes and active galaxies. This is a different facet. This is the stuff that goes on in normal galaxies. There have probably been these kinds of events in our galaxy, you know, once every 10,000 to 100,000 years. The reason why we can see them here is because if you're looking at, say, a few hundred thousand galaxies like you're looking at in this image, you're going to get a few of these tidal disruption events.
Eric, I'm looking at this image. There's two things about this image that really jump out at me. One is that each of these little specks is a galaxy, and it makes me feel very, very small. And two is these are images that were compared from a year apart, and I'm looking at this image, there's about 80 objects that are circled that have shown these kind of changes in light. When I think about the universe, I think of it as such a time is so large, right? The universe is 13 billion years old. When you look at this image, things are happening fast and they're happening a lot. And so it's wild.
That's exactly right. These are events that happen on the kinds of timescales that we understand. And these are the births and deaths of stars. And these are exciting things happening around supernovae. There's a set of three images, just examples of these circled objects. And you can see what has changed, you know, what some of these objects are. Each one of them is a supernova. You can see they're in different locations in galaxies. They're at different times of the universe. And it's just really exciting. And it's a thing we don't think about.
Let's talk about another image, Eric, the question mark galaxy. This is a gorgeous image, but what am I looking at here?
You're looking at a couple of things. I'm going to have to talk about the foreground and the background in this image. Okay, the foreground is a cluster of galaxies. And when you're looking at that image, those are the galaxies that are in white because of the way they did the colors. That foreground cluster is more or less your run-of-the-mill cluster of galaxies. that happens to be in the universe now. But what it's doing is that it is lensing the light from some background galaxies, and one in particular, this question mark galaxy, it's lensing it multiple times. And so you have these multiple images of this galaxy that have been lensed to make them look like a question mark. And visually, it's just amazing.
When you say lens, what do you mean?
Gravity bends light. And so what you're looking at is the effect of the gravity from all of these galaxies and also from the gas that's in that cluster. And it's bending the light from this background galaxy that we call the question mark.
That's also kind of wild to think about, that there's these forces that are bending light and you're able to observe them through this telescope. That is absolutely wild.
Right. If we talk about that one, and if we talk about this PLCK G16 5.7 and supernova HOPE, you know, you have this cluster of galaxies in the foreground, and in that particular case, the cluster has kind of two centers, and each of them is bending the light so that you see an arc with multiple images of galaxies. And the neat thing there, too, is that in one of those galaxies that you see multiply imaged, there's a supernova.
All right, Eric, we have to talk about this, and I'm so glad it is on your list because it was one of my favorite images from the Hubble Space Telescope, and I am so glad that astronomers are making additional observations of the Pillars of Creation. Tell me about why this one is so near and dear to your heart.
First of all, as you said, it's a gorgeous image. Just for everybody who's listening, this is a cloud of gas that's forming lots and lots of stars in our own galaxy. And you've got these three pillars, which when looked at in infrared light, you can see all of these gases, all of the forming stars and all of the gas regions peeking out. The neat thing about it is that, so Webb, because it's an infrared telescope, can peer behind the obscuring gas that Hubble couldn't see through, right? Hubble, if you look at some of these pillars, the inner part of them appeared dark with maybe just a few light streaks through that. And of course, you have to wonder, well, what's there, right? Is this just a region where there is no starlight, or is there something blocking the starlight? Well, when Webb looks at it and sees the stars and sees all of these filaments in the gas structure, and it sees that first because it has better resolution, and second because it's an infrared telescope. So when it looks in the infrared, it just cuts through the obscuration. It's really fascinating and beautiful. One of the neat things also is that with these two sets of images combined, you can sort of build a 3D model of the pillars, which is really neat because the stuff that Webb revealed that is inside, right? This is stuff that Hubble couldn't see. And so you're getting a three-dimensional view. If you go to the website, you find the pillars image right next to it. There is a 3D model that has been printed, and it was basically made using these data. And I mean, it's fascinating, and it's just really cool.
This makes me want to put on like a set of VR goggles and go flying through the Pillars of Creation. There would be nothing more comforting and inspiring than actually being able to be inside this cloud, right?
Oh, yeah. And you know something? That has got to be the next thing, right? I mean, they're doing a 3D printing. Somebody has got to be working on a VR of this, because that VR would just be amazing.
With that said, Eric, I know just from speaking with you and other astronomers and physicists, just how vital and important the data from JWST is to the understanding of our universe and how it works and where we are. You can't underscore that. But these images are just incredibly breathtaking, beautiful, artistic. How is JWST inspiring people that wouldn't be exposed to this kind of data or these kind of images before? And is that really helping the work that you do in getting people interested in the universe they live in?
So JWST inspires people all around the world, because it gives them a new vision of the universe, really reveals brand new details about all kinds of things, from stars forming to black holes, distant galaxies, exoplanets, things in our solar system. It's doing what Hubble did, but it's doing it better, and it's doing it to a whole new generation. And I think that's really important to realize. You know, Hubble, for our generation, Hubble was a revolution, right? It was a new view of the universe. And it was something, from my perspective as somebody in their mid-50s, I had this view of what the universe was when I was in school. Then Hubble came along, and Hubble changed it completely. Hubble came along in the 1990s, right? And so that's for my generation. Well, we're 35 years later than Hubble, right? Because Hubble was launched in 1990, and now we're in 2024, JWST is doing that for a new generation. And the images are just, they're so much better than Hubble's, and they're also in a different part of the spectrum. And you asked about how important it is and what it can do for the kinds of things I do. I think it's a couple things. So first of all, science doesn't get done, and science doesn't get communicated to the public without there being a huge interest in this new view of the universe, in finding things out. JWST gives that to us. This view that the universe is this package that's waiting to be unwrapped, and we're always finding new things about it. And we have a universe that's there for us to discover if we want to take the time to do that. And then the second thing is that the fact is that it doesn't happen if money and resources aren't spent on doing projects like this. Whether you're talking about the government doing this or whether you're talking about a private company doing this. And what's going to get them to do this? Public interest is going to get them to do this. Yes, you have millionaires and public figures that get interested in this. But without millions of people being interested in these images and the spectra and in finding the answers to questions about the universe, fundamental questions, those things just die. And it doesn't happen.
Well, luckily we have those images to look at. And luckily we have someone like Eric Perlman to walk us through what we're actually looking at. So Eric Perlman is a professor of physics and space sciences at Florida Tech. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, well, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. We got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? It is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.